Hello and welcome to Burning River Basketball episode 11. This is actually take two because Ben didn't push the right buttons the first time.
We're speaking in third person 30 seconds in.
Yep.
It's already.
And it's going to continue. Ben thinks it's going to continue. So anyway, unfortunately for you all, you missed about 4.5 minutes of really good basketball analysis. But like we were just saying, better 4.5 than, 44 or whatever it ends up being. So I am here with Danny Cunningham and goofball Jared Donnelly. How are you guys doing today?
Terrific.
Hanging in there, buckets.
Good. So the Cavaliers just wrapped up. Well, it's been probably about an hour now, but they wrapped up a game one, series two opening win against the Toronto Raptors, which pretty much consisted of the Cavaliers dominating all but 6 or 7 minutes of the second quarter. And I don't know, it was a good sight to see. Let me get your opening reactions to the Cavalier game, starting with you, Danny.
So essentially what tonight did confirmed my previous belief that the Toronto Raptors have zero chance of beating the Cleveland Cavaliers 4 times in 7 games. I'm not sure they have a chance of beating them 2 times in 7 games. The Raptors don't know what they want to do defensively. In the past, they've toyed with making sure if someone beats you, it's LeBron, which is fine. That's an interesting strategy to take, but it's definitely one that you can take against the Cavs. And, I mean, hope for the best, prepare for the worst type thing. And in order to combat that, they went out this season and they acquired PJ Tucker. They acquired Serge Ibaka. They already had Damari Carroll. They essentially were looking for a guy that could be a quote-unquote LeBron stopper, or at least someone who could slow him down. And it turns out that none of those guys can do that. They tried Damari Carroll. He didn't do very well, obviously. He was a minus 15, only played 15 minutes tonight. Serge Ibaka was nice offensively, but LeBron still had his way when he was on offense. And PJ Tucker really stands no chance of trying to guard LeBron either. So what the Raptors want to do is eliminate the Cavs from taking wide-open three-pointers all the time, and they were still 41% from beyond the arc with 14-34, but there's nothing that the Raptors can do defensively to stop the Cavs on offense. Now, do the Cavs have to play good defense? Yes, and at times they really did, and we'll get to that, but the Cavs can outscore the Raptors any single night, and I have zero doubts about that. It might not always be pretty, and it might be extremely frustrating at times for Cavs fans because the games could be close and they might not play great defense. But there are zero doubts in my mind that the Cavs can get whatever they want at any time on the offensive end of the floor against the Raptors.
Jared?
Yeah, I think you're right. And I mean, you mentioned it. The Cavs did play good defense, but I don't know that there's another team, certainly in the playoffs now that Oklahoma City is eliminated, that has to try so hard to get their points and to do things that they're good at, you know. And they were doing a lot of weird stuff where they like to do the high screen and roll action with Patrick Patterson or Serge Ibaka up top, and then those guys were just kind of hovering around the outside. Well, at that point, you're not stretching the Cavs defense, which is when they're bad, right? Is when they have to stretch out, and then no one fills in to help out when there's penetration. So if those guys aren't driving hard through the middle and diving through the lane, then the Cavs really don't have to do much defensively. And the Raptors' strategy of, you know, PJ Tucker is a 3-and-D guy, allegedly. Serge Ibaka is a 3-and-D guy, allegedly. And you go get those guys for defense, right? But you're also thinking maybe they can help you stretch the floor a little bit. But rather than do that, they forced a lot of mid-range contested jump shots, as opposed to taking what Cleveland was giving them and allowing that to funnel through to what they do well and get open looks that way. And I thought there was a strange strategy by Dwayne Casey, who is he's a good NBA coach, but I don't know that he's a championship caliber NBA coach for reasons like that. You know, schematically and in terms of his rotations and things, it's very uneven. It's very inconsistent. And I spent a lot of time trying to figure out what exactly his plan was, especially for a while there in the first quarter. They were force-feeding Valanciunas the ball underneath. And I'm thinking to myself, well, for what? Like, he went from being a great post player with moves on moves on moves, and now he's a paperweight. So it seemed like they had to work really, really hard for what they got, and they still didn't get anything of any real measurable quality.
Yeah, now that we've got past the portion that we recorded once already, I'll go ahead and I'll weigh in. I'll weigh in on my view, kind of piggybacking off of what Danny said. You know, all three of us were really talking about this before the game. What were the Raptors going to do? Were they going to counter the Cavaliers' big lineup with a small lineup, or were they going to try to match the Cavaliers and go from there? They really tried to go back to the bigger lineup, which obviously meant that there was going to be a heavier emphasis on trying to force feed a guy like Valanciunas a little bit. And basically what happened was Serge Ibaka, who's the team's best rim protector — I don't really count Jonas Valanciunas as a rim protector, I don't really think you can — but Serge Ibaka was guarding Kevin Love out around the perimeter, and the Cavaliers were just dicing their way to the basket. Tristan Thompson was superb for the Cavaliers, registering a plus 33. So I don't know that exactly what Dwayne Casey did was any type of effective, and it'll be interesting to see, I guess, what he does going forward, because you can't assume that he's going to do the exact same thing after, for the most part, the Raptors got mauled for the duration of this game. Now, the Cavaliers' second unit was really, really bad in this game. Do you see that hurting them throughout the series? And this time we'll start with Jared.
I don't think so. I mean, obviously you want them to play well. Shumpert had good energy, and I think it was our first podcast of the year, at least the first one that I was on, I mentioned that I didn't think the Cavs could repeat as world champions without getting something positive in spurts from Iman Shumpert. And he was minus 16 today, but the whole second unit was, and you still saw spurts. And I think there was one stretch with that second unit on the floor where the Cavs, in about 3.5 minutes, had manufactured themselves — what I say, and I think I mentioned it in a text to you guys — that they had manufactured 6 or 7 three-pointers that by any stretch of the imagination, anybody with a brain would have considered to be wide open. Those shots will fall. So that minus 16, again, like we said, the theme of the game is that the statistics don't bear it out. Real quick, I wanted to touch on a point you made about Dwayne Casey and whether he was going to go large when the Cavs went small and how he was going to kind of counter things. In the NBA, you can win games and score points on offense in the half court two different ways, right? You can attack the basket and then spread the floor, or you can spread the floor and use the spread to attack, right? And Toronto doesn't seem like they're super interested in doing either of those. They kind of want to spread. They kind of don't. They kind of want to screen and roll. They sort of want to ISO DeRozan. But if you ISO DeRozan, you're taking the ball out of your best player's hands. And at that point, like I said, you're forcing wing threes with Patterson with 6 seconds left on the clock. And you're doing all these weird things. And I think if you're going, especially being as the Cavs' second unit was so bad and they still didn't make a run, Dwayne Casey's going to have to adjust that. And I think if Toronto's going to win any basketball games this series, they're going to have to go small when the Cavs are big, and then go big when the Cavs are small and hammer the glass. That's when you force feed Valanciunas. That's when you get Patrick Patterson on the elbow extended and let him do some things. But you can't just continue to force contested 18-footers.
Yeah, forcing contested 18-footers gets you absolutely nowhere in today's NBA. I mean, if you look at why the Rockets are successful, yeah, their system's a little bit different. They play a little bit different style of basketball than most teams, but what do? They shoot layups and they shoot three-pointers. They're either attacking the basketball or trying to get the extra value out of the possession. The Raptors are taking low-percentage two-point shots, which is the last thing you want to do. If you're taking a low-percentage shot and it goes in, you want to be getting 3 points for it. If you're taking a two, you want it to be as close to the rim as physically possible. Like, there is no in-between in today's NBA, which I think is something that's interesting, but it's something the Raptors don't really seem to believe in.
Yeah, real quick, that's sort of what I call my NBA jam theory, right?
Like,
all of
these
NBA teams that are super successful have general managers that sort of were around and of an appropriate age to play a ton of NBA jam. And that was two-man game, dunks and threes and block shots, and nothing else mattered. And in the face of the new NBA sort of trending that way, the Raptors have said, yeah, but we'd rather win the 1999 NBA Finals, and now they're trying to mid-range the hell out of everybody, and they're going to get run out of their own gym.
Yeah, you're exactly right. They're definitely going to get run out of the queue.
In the past five playoff games that they've played, or four playoff games, excuse me, that they've played at the Q now, games one and two last year and game five last year and game one tonight, the Raptors have lost by a combined 99 points to the Cavs inside of Quicken Loans
That's
Arena.
That's awesome.
That is incredible.
Wow.
That is incredible. Here's my concern with, I don't know, this the Cavaliers' second unit. Say Dwayne Casey changes up what he does and he goes small to start game two. And what he then decides to do is say, you know what, we don't need to match up with the Cavaliers' small second unit. We can go ahead and just go big against the second unit because the Cavaliers' second unit hasn't been, well, I don't want to say it hasn't been, but at least in game one, they were not effective. If they're not effective in game two, again, and the Cavaliers are hammering Valanciunas in there against Channing Frye, does that concern you at all? Or are you still not concerned because of, you know, the fact that when the Cavaliers go ahead and put their starters back in, they're going to hammer the Raptors?
I'm not concerned because, like I said, tonight confirmed that the Raptors can't win this series. So really nothing outside of injuries is going to really concern me in this series. Now, if this keeps up and, say, when they get to the finals, yeah, it's a concern. But against the Raptors, I'm not worried about much.
In terms of the Raptors potentially winning the series, am I concerned? No. But in terms of there will be some aftershocks, right? Then all of a sudden we live in a world where we need Channing Frye to be a post defender, which he's a little bit below average post defender. He's not as bad as a lot of people think. But what that does is now he's down there banging with Valanciunas. And then he is productive on offense because now he also has to play the offensive glass a little bit more to keep Valanciunas off and these sorts of things. So in terms of can the Raptors win the series because of it, I could not be less concerned about that. But in terms of it potentially changing the dynamics of the rotation for Cleveland, maybe, because I think Dwayne Casey going that way and sort of countering big with small and vice versa, I think that he can sort of dictate, I shouldn't say it that way, it provides Toronto with an opportunity to potentially dictate tempo. And I think the Cavs are good enough to combat that, but I don't like the idea that somebody else knows how to potentially do it. And I think that's what's a little bit concerning.
That's fair, and I would agree with that.
All right, well, I don't really know where to go next, guys. You want to talk about Dante Jones a little bit and what the heck must have just happened there at the end of that game?
I want to know what he said. Like, honestly, I would pay $50 to know what came out of his mouth.
I think, like we said earlier, I think Poeltl would too. I don't think he had any idea what was going on. I mean, did you see him? He just sort of stood there like, why are you doing this to me? You know,
I understand why Dante did what he did.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, it's an
unwritten basketball rule that if a team's up 20, it doesn't matter if you're down, you're not pressing their second unit. You're not thrown out like a full-court trap.
Third unit. Jones
you're right.
is on the floor.
You're right. So when Dante Jones went ahead and threw that down and had a couple words to say about it, then I had no problem with that. I'm interested more, I think, into what why he continued to say what he did and got the second technical and then got ejected. I mean,
I'm not sure he was given two technicals. I think he was given one tech that was just an ejection. Cause you can eject.
No, they had a double technical on him and Poeltl. And then afterwards Dante was yapping. And I think they teed him up again and ran him.
Yeah.
Okay. Let me check out the official box score.
Well, that's why the Raptors
be ejected with only one tech.
Right.
Like Steph Curry got tossed in game six of the finals on one tech. Granted, he fouled out, but you can be tossed on one tech.
Right, but I mean, the whole free throw thing is kind of explained by, you know, there was a double technical and the extra technical is why the Raptors got to shoot that free throw. So
that's why Norman Powell got the free throw, as far as I knew. But I think, you know, in Danny said it on Twitter.
He was
given
two technicals.
Okay. I think Danny said it on Twitter. He's like, if you're going to press down 20, you deserve every bit of Dante Jones. And that's kind of the thing. Like, if you want to play defense in the backcourt like it's game seven, Dante Jones is going to splatter the arena with you like it's game seven, and he's going to tell you about it like it's game seven. So,
as he should. He has every right to.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. And that's sort of we had a, on the last podcast we did the game one of Indiana, well, last one I was on at least, it, we sort of had the conversation like, why Dante Jones over Liggins? What three of us been, and Cavs fans and NBA people all over the country been talking about this Cavs team? No killer instinct. They don't have that mean streak. They don't want to step on your throat when you're laying on the ground. And Dante Jones is now twice in his last two playoff series, or he's got three playoff series, has done that, and he's provided that. Whereas DeAndre Liggins, I'm sure he's a great guy, but he's flat out not doing that. And I think that sort of edge is nice.
Yeah, Dante Jones doesn't, or DeAndre Liggins doesn't do what Dante Jones did tonight.
Absolutely not.
Here's something for you. I can't remember. While you guys were talking, I was searching for the tweet, and I can't remember who tweeted it, and I'll probably find out as soon as I get done saying this. But somebody, a Cavs reporter, tweeted that Dante Jones made something in the ballpark of, you know, the $8,000.
Oh, it was Brian. It was Brian Winhurst. He tweeted out that Dante Jones made $9,000 from the Cavs this season. He was just fined $6,000 for two texts and an injection.
That's perfect. Something else. You think LeBron's picking up that tab?
LeBron did say he would pick it up postgame.
Oh, did he? I missed that.
Did he? Okay, good.
He also said that him and Dante need to have a talk.
Well, they panned over to LeBron afterwards, and you could tell if that game was closer than it was, LeBron would have not been thrilled about Dante yapping after what was effectively a 1-point dunk, right?
Because, well, you know, if it were closer than it was, Dante would have been clapping on the sidelines.
I guess that's the only argument to make there, isn't it?
I can't imagine. I mean, he hasn't played meaningful minutes since the closing moments of Game 6 of the first half of Game 6 of the Finals last year. That was the last time he played a meaningful minute. It was when he had 5 points in 11 seconds.
All right,
which totally trumps whatever Reggie Miller did in 8.9.
Oh, for sure, no doubt about it.
And T-Max 13 and 33.
Say what?
Yeah, the T-Mac could spill it.
Oh, 13 and 33. Yeah, that was something else.
13 points in 33 seconds against the Spurs. It was incredible.
Yeah.
The thing that I like the most is that against Indiana, you know, I think the total margin of victory in that series for the Cavs was 16 points. They outscored Indiana by 16 points over the course of four games. At halftime, the Cavs are up 12. They won. They were up at one point by 20, 21. I can't remember what it was.
They're up by 25 at one point.
Okay, there you go. So they're getting better as the competition gets better, right? And I think it's nice that at the end of a Cavs playoff win, the three of us aren't in a group text wondering what a 12-4 run by the opposition meant with 2 minutes left, you know? I'm not beside myself standing in the kitchen doing dishes instead of watching the Cavs have a playoff game because I can't handle them not closing out. They closed out quarters really, really well. They rotated great defensively, as you pointed out during the game, Danny. They did a lot of things, and I guess if you want one takeaway, the fact that we're talking about Dante Jones after a playoff win is probably the best thing you can say about any playoff win.
That's absolutely 100%. You are spot on. And you did bring up something that jogged my memory. The Cavs played, especially in that first quarter, you sent us a text. The Cavs haven't been this emotionally invested since December 25th.
Oh, yeah.
That's something we need to talk about.
Well, and what really set me off with that was the Kyrie 3 and then the Kyrie dish to Love. And they were animated, and it was right out of the gate. Kyrie lobbing it up to LeBron, and everyone was enthusiastic. I really feel like those 7 days they had off, and if you think about it, this is probably true. Those 7 days that they had off between game four against Indy and game one tonight against Toronto was probably the most time that they've had to spend together not doing basketball stuff since the beginning of October.
Yeah.
LeBron was quoted as saying, we didn't practice as much as we practiced in the last 7 weeks in the entire month of March.
Right. Well, that and not only that, but I mean, like, outside of basketball, you know, guys have a week to get back to doing what they did, which made them so great in the playoffs last year, was they genuinely liked being around each other. And if you look on all the social media, the Cavs are always at someone's house watching some game, or they're always out doing something with somebody, or RJ's giving Channing Frye's brother a hard time on Snapchat or something. And having that layoff not only rest, but also to give them a chance to kind of remember, hey, we like each other and we're really good at this, I think is a little bit of an underrated thing in terms of team chemistry translating over into that emotional outpouring, I guess you could say, for lack of a better term, that we saw early on in the game.
One thing that I want to talk about real quickly that you guys kind of touched on and, I don't know, maybe didn't emphasize as much as I want to emphasize it right now, is can we just talk about the fact that Kyrie went off the backboard to LeBron in a playoff game?
That's the most disrespectful thing that's been done in the NBA since J.R. Smith threw a behind-his-head lob in Game 6 of the Finals.
I tell you, like, the most disrespectful part about that might have been that LeBron crossed half court, was 15 feet behind Kyrie, and immediately was pointing up, right? But he had barely crossed half court. Kyrie had the ball somewhere just inside the three-point line, and LeBron was already pointing up, like, you're going to lob this to me right now. And there were two defenders back. Like, he knew immediately. He's like, we don't care about the Raptors. We don't care about this transition defense. I'm hammering one on him. Like, that might be the most disrespectful thing, is he had it planned before it was even realistic to think about it.
Yeah. At that moment, I tweeted out, so this series is over, because for all intents and purposes, that moment, the Raptors lost any chance of winning the series.
Oh, yeah. Immediately. Took them right out of the game.
I mean, you can't have something that disrespectful done to you and come back and win. You just can't.
No,
absolutely. One thing I want to touch on that's maybe a little bit on more serious terms that we started to talk on later before we started to have a little bit of fun with this, but the Cavaliers closed out for the first time really all playoffs. They closed out quarters, and particularly the fourth quarter for the most part, pretty well. I think did you guys find it interesting at all that LeBron James, despite the fact that the Cavaliers were up by close to 20 for most of the second half, LeBron James went out for the last, I don't know, minute or so of the third quarter and was right back on the court to start the fourth?
I'm not going to fret over this because he just had 7 days off. Say Indiana would have pushed them to six games, the way Toronto was pushed to six against Milwaukee, and the series would have ended last Thursday or Friday, and then game one's today. It would bother me because LeBron would have had that much more mileage done. But LeBron hadn't played since last Sunday, and today is a full week after that. I mean, they had a full 7 days off. So therefore, him playing 41 minutes in 2 seconds does not bother me one bit.
Well, I think what, in terms of what you said, Ben, where he came out for a minute or two at the end of the third and then was back out there to start the fourth, that tells me that, this isn't sourced, right? This is just me watching an inordinate amount of hoops. It tells me that Ty Lue thought to himself, look, we don't close games out well, so we better start the quarter well. So if he's sitting LeBron for that extra minute or two, and then he's got, what, a 3 or 4 minute commercial break, that's 7 or 8 minutes of real-time rest where he's not playing. Get back out there, start it strong with the idea of maybe we'll be up by enough that we won't need him out there to close it out, instead of waiting and giving him his normal 5-6 basketball minutes rest at the beginning of the fourth or whatever that number is, and then sticking him out there in a position where he has to close it. I think that was sort of the decision made, and frankly, it's not so much how many minutes, it's what kind of minutes, right? So if LeBron plays 41 minutes and they're up by, I'm making this up, but they're up on average by 18 points or whatever it is, those minutes aren't as physically, mentally, emotionally draining and damaging as 8-9 minutes at the beginning of the fourth, or I'm sorry, 8-9 minutes at the end of the fourth, where he has to be the guy to close games out when teams make runs.
Yeah, absolutely. I think a great point that you made, that in the, you know, I dabble in the basketball coaching world a little bit. One thing that we always talk about as a coaching staff of the girls that I coach is not necessarily minutes played, but definitely the real-time rest thing that you were talking about. And,
yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
If you can get a player, you know, the last 45 seconds of the end of a quarter plus the timeout, they've in reality actually sat for, in the NBA it's longer because you have TV timeouts that take minutes and minutes and minutes.
Right.
In a high school game, it's not, or even a small college game, it's not the same because you don't have those TV timeouts. But even in a high school game, they're sitting for 2-3 minutes before they go back in. They've only actually sat out, you know, 45 seconds of game time, and then you're talking about how, well, they only sat out like one full minute and they got to be gassed. Well, it's not exactly it either. So, you know, I do like how they, it was the same in the first quarter where he went out. I don't know exactly what the time was. I don't have a photographic memory, but he went out with a minute or two in the first quarter. He actually got a minute or two to start the second quarter, and then he came in for Tristan Thompson. They went with that small lineup that didn't go well for them. But so the idea of real-time rest, I think, is definitely underrated. The one thing that I will say, I guess, is that it, and maybe you guys feel different, or maybe this is completely hypothetical, I don't know, but it does sort of concern me if they get into a 6 or 7 game grinder with a team like, I don't know, either the Celtics, Wizards, or in the finals, the Warriors or Rockets or Spurs. Or
You can remove Celtics from that conversation. That will not be a 6 or 7 game grinder.
Well, let's just pretend that maybe it is. At some point, some point in the playoffs, they're going to play a grinder series. I mean, if they want to win the title. I mean, maybe
it will happen in June.
Maybe they get blown out in June. It's not a grinder, but I don't know. But I don't think that'll happen, for the record. But I guess it does concern me a little bit that still in May, on May 1st, that instead of, I don't know, it seems like if this would have happened in the regular season where the Cavs go into the fourth quarter up 18 or 19 points, whatever they were, LeBron James, you know, Ty Lue would have wanted to rest LeBron James as long as he could in the hopes that maybe he doesn't have to put him back in the fourth quarter. And it does kind of bug me just a little bit that he doesn't have that confidence to do it in a playoff game. Obviously, the playoffs, the stakes are higher, but I don't know. I wish the confidence was there. I wish we knew more about the Cavs, or what we knew about the Cavs was better, that we didn't have to worry about them, you know, after a game where they dominated, for the most part, blowing the lead in the fourth quarter. And actually, the start of the fourth quarter wasn't exactly pretty. I think the Toronto Raptors, let's go with that, made a couple shots right there at the beginning of the fourth. I want to say it was like a 5-2 run just right in like the first like 30 seconds, to the point where Ty Lue had to call a timeout and be like, guys, we're not doing this. Like, let's keep our focus for another 6 minutes. And that, to me, is the slightest bit concerning.
Well, I agree to an extent. But at the same time, like, at no time during a Toronto Raptors run did I feel like, oh no, here we go again, right? I mean, the Cavs in the first half shot 42% from the field, and it felt like they had a chokehold on it. So I was okay. I understand what you're saying, and like you said, in a grit and grind series, that may happen. But I want to be clear, the Cavs will beat the Celtics. But I do think, in terms of, like I said earlier, the physical nature of the minutes, even if it's only a 5 or 6 game series or whatever, the physical nature of those minutes and the style of play against Boston is going to be that style, is going to be that grit and grind. It's going to feel like you played Memphis, you know, and I think that they'll be okay, because I think that the Cavs have enough where they can dictate some tempo. Even when Deron Williams comes in, you know, he can still get up and down and play quickly, and he can still play quickly within the half court, right? Because pace, it doesn't mean you play fast. Pace is the speed at which you do anything. It doesn't necessarily mean it's happening quickly. So if they can continue in those sorts of instances to still play fast in the half court, even though their transition game has been limited due to the physical nature of the style of play, they'll be okay. You know, get into your stuff quickly, be crisp, execute, get guys moving on a string and flip that ball around, make sure that ball has its own energy, and you'll be all right, even in that style of play, even if LeBron isn't necessarily on the floor.
Danny, you concerned at all?
Not even the slightest bit.
All right.
With that type of thing. I do want to point out something that is weird just looking over at the box score here. The only person on the Cavs that missed multiple free throws is Kyrie Irving tonight. And that's with LeBron and Tristan Thompson shooting free throws. Kyrie's the only one that missed more than one.
Yep, LeBron was 7 for 8.
Tristan was terrific.
And Tristan Thompson was 5 of 6.
Yep.
Kyrie Irving shot the lowest percentage from the line on the Cavs. That's incredible.
That is weird.
Last thing that I really want to talk about is how much longer can we depend on Channing Frye?
I don't think they depend on him. I mean, he didn't play well tonight, and I mean, he's out there to make threes, and he was 1 of 3 tonight. But, I mean, they don't depend on him. It's not like he's It's not like, hey, Channing, go protect the rim. It's, hey, Channing, go be a sub, come off the bench, and hit open threes. Like, that's...
See, here's the thing. I understand what you're saying, and conceptually it's 100% accurate. My thing is they absolutely do depend on him, if for no other reason than they don't have the depth at that position to not get quality minutes from him right now. If
sure.
Someone has to fill those minutes. And as long as Channing Frye is getting open looks and shooting the ball and helping out on help defense when he finds himself in those situations, they absolutely are depending on him. Because, I don't know, the alternative is James Jones. No one feels good about that, and we know that because he doesn't play. So, like, they don't depend on him to be a difference maker in a lot of ways or a game changer. They're depending on him to eat minutes in a positive way. He's like the fourth starter in a pitching rotation, right? You don't need him to strike out 12 guys. You don't need him to not give up any runs or keep guys off of the bases. You need him to eat 5 or 6 innings every time he's out there and not implode. And I think they can get another year out of Channing Frye doing that.
Yeah, I guess as I look forward, and you know, maybe this is entitled Cavalier fan of me speaking, but when I look forward to something like the finals, I don't see the idea of playing Channing Frye against somebody really good like any of these Western Conference teams.
I think the only team you really can't play him against is Golden State. I think you could play him against the Spurs, who I, as of me talking, are down by 32 to Houston as the second half opens. So I don't like them getting out of the West if the rest of the playoffs is going to go like this for them. But I think you can play him against the Rockets. I think he's a tough play against the Warriors because of how they play small versus how other teams play small. But I could see him on the floor against the Rockets. I don't think he's a fit.
Well, do you think that and hang with me here, but do you think that Houston is having this conversation about whether or not they can play Ryan Anderson against Golden State? Because they're the same guy.
Yeah. They,
you know
what
I mean? Like at no point is, and here's the deal. Like there aren't, more than, and I truly believe that I don't think there are more than roughly 3 to 5 stretch fours in the league that teams feel good about playing against Golden State. I just don't think that there are, because that's the nature of a stretch four. You know, and Golden State will target you in pick and rolls, and they will murder you every single time. And you just understand that you're going to take a minus from your third or fourth big. You're going to take a minus against Golden State when they go small, and you hope that he's a plus offensively, or at least, like I said, doesn't implode. The whole thing for Channing Frye is go out there, take open shots, and be where you're supposed to be when you're supposed to be there. Some nights he's going to get 14-6. Some nights he'll go 1-3 from three, and it's not really his game. But he is still, hands down, the best option the Cavs have there. And I'm not worried about him playing in Golden State in a series. Not any more than I would be any other backup big in the league.
That's fair.
All right. Well, that's it for me. Either of you guys have anything you want to add?
LeBron said postgame he is not a beer drinker. Thoughts?
He's more of a wine in his driveway type of guy.
Yes.
Wine in his driveway.
He's more of a red wine in the driveway than a Bud Light at the queue.
Yep. Yeah.
Well, the one thing that was interesting that we didn't touch on was Richard Jefferson being odd man out.
Yeah.
What do you think of
that? I don't think it's impactful going forward, but it's funny because what reminded me of that was the Channing Frye conversation. Do we feel better with Richard Jefferson being that third or fourth big and taking the bulk of those minutes away from Channing Frye, or do we like Channing Frye in that role better?
I think Richard Jefferson in small stretches can chase around Kevin Durant, and that's something we saw in Christmas. And I said this to maybe both of you, maybe just Ben, that Richard Jefferson could realistically be a difference between the Cavs winning a title and not winning a title, because if he can in small stretches do what he was able to do on Christmas against Kevin Durant, then the Cavs are in a much better situation than if he can't do anything against Kevin Durant. Is he going to stop one of the greatest scorers of all time? No. No chance. Absolutely none. Can he slow him down better than most others coming off the bench? Yeah. And, but I mean, I also made this comment before Derek Williams was on the team, because I think he's also someone that in 3 to 4 minute spurts could chase around Kevin Durant and survive and not implode. But I would feel better about those two on the floor against Golden State in that role than I would Channing Frye. Yeah. Obviously, they're not as good offensively, and they're not most likely not going to be able to fill it up the way from three that Channing Frye can when he's on. But it's the other end of the floor that I think they have a much more significant advantage over Channing Frye.
Yeah, not even just Kevin Durant. Like, against the Warriors bench, you have to stop guys like Sean Livingston as well. And that's where I think that a guy like Richard Jefferson definitely could come in and probably guard Sean Livingston, who for the most part ate the Cavaliers alive in that second unit for the duration of the last year's finals and the finals before that, for that matter. So I think that that might be significant as well.
Yeah, and I think I know this isn't what you were saying, but I think that if it comes down to playing Richard Jefferson because of defensive versatility, where he can get switchy and zip over to Livingston, I don't think that's a concern. Because like you said, Livingston ate the Cavs alive, but where did he do it from? Like 14 feet.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. So,
but it's not so much Livingston for me. It's KD. That's
well, right, and that's what I'm saying is, like, while it's a nice bonus that a guy like Jefferson can bounce around and you can do some different things and different schemes defensively, and he can guard, you know, 3 to 4 positions probably, I'm not super concerned about whether he can guard 3 or 4 positions. I'd rather have someone that's average against 2 but dynamic on offense.
Absolutely. You guys want to talk about our friends, the Warriors, real quick?
Yeah, I did. As soon as we got in this conversation, CBS Sports reported that the Warriors are expecting Steve Kerr to not return for the remainder of the playoffs. That leaves our good friend Mike Brown in charge of that franchise. Mike Brown is a tremendous human being. He's a very upstanding person, a great guy. That being said, he's not a good basketball coach. What are your thoughts on the Warriors now being run by Mike Brown?
I mean, I'm not going to say that it's going to affect them a whole lot, because obviously the system's in place and he's the one that's really just now going to, be in charge of rotations and things. And I think Steve Kerr is still behind closed doors helping that. So I don't know that it really affects them a whole lot at all.
I agree. And the other thing that was that you, when you said rotations, it jogged my memory a little bit about something that used to make me just absolutely an insane person about Mike Brown was do you guys remember he was so beholden to his rotations sheet and his minutes sheet, that stupid laminated thing that he would hold on the sideline? Right? So you assume, if that's how he wants to manage things, you assume that Steve Kerr is going to go ahead and have his secretary print up an Excel sheet for Coach Mike, and Coach Mike's going to look at that, and they're not going to be his rotations so much as they're going to be Steve Kerr's rotations that have already been in place for 2-3 years now, right? So
Steve Kerr hasn't exactly been good at rotations, though. Like, he's been good at a lot of things. Rotations hasn't been one of them.
Yeah. It's hard for me to indict Steve Kerr on any basketball-related matters after winning, 600 games the last 2 years in a title. Like, I'm good with whatever he decides.
He also blew a 3-1 lead because he insisted on playing Anderson Varejao big minutes in a Game 7 of the finals.
I was a defender of that decision, actually.
I was against it. I mean, I was all for it, obviously.
Well, I was a defender for the same reason. I think it wound up hurting them, but I thought it was the right move for the same reason I was a little bit skeptical when the Cavs traded Andy for Channing Frye, which was, if you're playing an elite pick and roll team, you have to have a pick and roll defender. And we didn't realize it at the time because Andy hadn't played meaningful minutes in Cleveland much that year. But going into that season, Anderson Varejao was still thought of and still had a reputation as being a really good pick and roll defender. So that I understood where he was coming with in those rotations. But I'll tell you what, if Andy was anywhere near that roster, I don't know if anyone would be able to stop Mike Brown from playing him 35 minutes.
And I wish he was.
I mean, ditto. Like, the Warriors are going to be fine. They're going to blow through the West. I think Houston can beat them. I don't think that they will. I think it's just going to come down to them just being better. But I think that'll be a little bit of a series. Hopefully they can push them some extra games. You know, hopefully they can wear them a little bit. Their two best players have a combined weight of like 240 pounds. So like maybe Houston can slam them around a little bit and get to the Cavs where the Hulk, can continue slamming them around and things like that. But the Warriors are going to be fine. Maybe they do too much partying in Utah and we don't have to worry about it anyways.
Yeah, how about that? That's what I actually wanted to talk about. I know Danny went with the Mike Brown thing, but whenever I brought up the Warriors, that's where I was going with this. Yeah.
That's awesome.
But I'm sitting here reading the article as you guys talk, and like there is, you know, Andre Iguodala seemed to be kind of like the poster boy for that article that came out, but there are a lot of funny quotes from Warriors players in this article from ESPN, and it was written by, let me take a look, it was written by Chris Haynes, our buddy. So
Haynes is a very, very good reporter.
My favorite is that, Kevin Durant is over here, and he's like, it's a few restaurants close to the hotel, but you're not scattered out. LA is just bigger. That's the only difference. And over here, then of course, they asked Mike Brown about it, and he said, see, I disagree. I think if you really want to find something to get into, I don't care where you are, you can find something to get into. So now acting coach Mike Brown isn't trying to dismiss, our players need to be focused on basketball, not the nightlife. He's just like, you know what, if you want to find something to get into in Utah, you can get into it. I don't know.
See, this is sort of an interesting thing, and I don't mean to keep doing this, but it's sort of interesting. Like I have to try really, really hard not to turn everything that Golden State does or says into Golden State being hysterical for the wrong reasons, right? Because I was thinking as we were talking about it, it was if LeBron had said, "Oh, well, I'm glad we're playing Toronto. The nightlife there is better. We'd all be talking about how confident LeBron was and how no one should be concerned because he's not concerned. He's the best player on the planet." So it's sort of interesting for me to see the sort of reaction among Cleveland fans, like, oh, they should be more focused on basketball, when I wonder, and I'm willing to bet that the reaction, if it was the Cavs players and Ty Lue having these conversations, it would be, oh, there's our Cavs. You know what I mean? And so it's sort of an interesting juxtaposition there. And I think we have to try really hard, and I try to do it all season, we have to try really hard to kind of not look at things in such a way that everything someone does is bad just because we don't like them. You know what I mean?
I mean, think the fact that they got Matt Barnes on a quote about it is the greatest thing in the world.
Absolutely.
I just want to hear what Matt Barnes has to say about everything.
His quote was, "No comparison. There's no such thing, man." Warriors forward Matt Barnes told ESPN on Utah nightlife. "There's no nightlife in Utah. Obviously, as players, you want to be able to have a little bit of a nightlife, but the main focus is winning games. Me personally, I want to get out there because I want to beat the Clippers. That's my former team, and my kids are out there. But as far as nightlife, there's no comparison to nightlife in Utah and LA."
That's beautiful. He's beautiful.
What a guy.
He's just the best.
He is something.
Yeah.
he's just terrific.
He is, in fact, something. Well.
And Andre Iguodala saying that it's hard to get pumped up for games because there's no nightlife in the city is my favorite thing in the world.
Yeah, like, just, well, then don't do that. You know, quit doing the thing you don't like. It's easy. You get to pick.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
If you don't like going out in Utah, stop going out in Utah. Move on.
Yep. I mean, they should only have to play two games there, you would think. But you never know. Utah's.
I'm pulling for my Jazz. You know, that's my, other than the Cavs, that's my biggest NBA love is the Jazz. I was jacked when they bounced out the Clippers, who I could not be more sick of.
I hope that team just blows up now.
They have to. Done. It's over. Yeah. Chris Paul's going to go to San Antonio. They're going to win the next four in a row.
Chris Paul's coming to Cleveland. The banana boat is being assembled.
Oh boy, here we go.
Dwayne Wade said he's open for anything. A lot of notable players have started to ring chase in year 14. Carmelo Anthony, soon to be traded from the Knicks.
That's not ring chasing.
Chris Paul?
No, Chris Paul would totally be ring chasing.
Yeah, that's what I'm talking
Carmelo
about.
Carmelo gets traded from the Knicks.
That's not ring chasing. The Chris Paul part would be ring chasing.
Yes.
Okay. Everything else would not be, but Chris Paul would be ring chasing.
Mm-hmm. Well, we could record a whole nother 45-minute podcast on Team Banana Boat. Maybe someday we will. So, but for now, I think this is a good wrap for us. Thanks for listening. Hopefully you listened all the way through here. Thanks for sticking with me, guys, after my technological snafu a little bit earlier. From Ben, Danny, Jared, a.k.a. Goofball, thanks for listening. Let's talk to you later.